And thanks, Walter, for letting me up here finally and for really pulling those announcements out of the garbage. It was a lot of eating alone on driveways and just having much fluffy time. Anyway, then all the good stuff happened, so that's perfect. Who's ready for some love this morning?
Yes.
Yeah. We're in the final week of Advent, and we've been peacing and what? Peacing and hoping and enjoying together, right? So this is the Sunday of loving. And depending on, so we've been doing this for 4 weeks, but you know, year after year, it's the same theme over and over. I wonder how many of you have, how many Decembers have people been Adventing? You want to shout out how many Decembers you've been going? I've been doing it for... Well, I grew up not in the liturgical tradition, so I've probably been doing it for about 20 years.
I'm sure I did it while it's in the womb.
So if you say how many Decembers you've been at this, you're going to say your age. Which you don't want. not getting too many volunteers on this. But have you noticed, I don't want to speak for everybody here this morning, but you know, maybe you've been through lots of Advents, but does it get any easier? Peacing, enjoying, and hoping, and loving year after year. You're like, I've been doing this for like 50, I've done this 50 times. It's easy now. I don't know, it doesn't feel like it, but what I love about December is that it's such a reminder that we are living into those things. And I mean, when you look at, I don't want to be a downer, but Walter already kind of set the table anyway. So, you know, think about the headlines of 2025, right? Like, if you just think about words that have...
No!
Don't do it. Yeah, no. But I don't want to be a downer, but you also can't live in denial, right? And Christmas is... Every year of human history, we've got this paradox happening. Peace, joy, hope, love. How do we do that? How am I supposed to do those things in the middle of, like, 2025 headlines? I'm going to take a shot at conveying some ancient wisdom about how we can actually do that this morning. But to get there, I thought this would be fun, you have to choose a door. All right, I'm just going to say, go ahead, start, try to come to an agreement. Which door are we going to tackle first? So we got Stephen, we got Wenceslas. I went with the... non-English feather, loss, because it sounds like Santa Claus, because it can't just be L-A-S. And then St. Stephen, New Brunswick. Where do you want to go?
That feels too
expensive. Okay, I'm hearing... Okay. How many want Stephen? Nobody wants the Bible this morning. That's what I'm getting. How many want Wenceslas? Okay, how many want St. Stephen, New Brunswick? Okay, we'll get to all of them. Clearly, Wenceslas is the winner. So, let me just see if I kind of go through here. Okay. Anybody know the song? Good King Wenceslas went out on the feast of Stephen. Here we go. Yeah. Okay, some of you are still going. Wow. Great. So this is a medieval. You can stop now. This is a medieval. It's a medieval Christmas carol. It's been through a lot of iterations over centuries, and it tells a really wonderful story. The scene opens on King Wenceslas on the feast of Stephen, as so many of you know. And based on that information so far, do you know where and when that is? Where? First, let's start with where. Where is it?
Eastern Europe.
Good. Wow. Nice. Okay, we've got Eastern Europe.
Czech Republic,
that is super impressive. But it wasn't the Czech Republic then. What was it then?
Bohemia.
Bohemia! Oh my gosh, we've got some real eggheads in this room. Good. It is Bohemia, currently the Czech Republic, and it is the 10th century. It is Eastern Europe. It's winter, snow on the ground, bitter cold. The king in the story, he looks out his window and he sees a poor man outside scrounging for firewood to keep warm. This isn't somebody looking for Boxing Day deals. This is somebody who's poor and it is after Christmas. The king asks the page, who is this man and where does he live in the song? And some of you would have sung the whole thing, but I had to stop. The page says that the man lives quite a distance away near the forest beneath the mountain. So that's likely in a shack or a cave outside of town. And the king springs into action. He orders food and wine and firewood to be gathered. And here's the real catch. He doesn't just send somebody to bring it to the man. He goes himself, and the page goes with him. And as they travel through the snow and through the wind, the page starts to struggle. He admits he can't keep going. He can't keep doing this. The cold is too much. This whole thing is too hard. And here's the miracle in the song. Spoiler, we're going to sing this on Christmas Eve. But this is what happens. The act of wonder in the song is what? Any guesses? Does the storm suddenly clear? Does the man suddenly become rich and not need their charity anymore? Do the king and the page teleport to the man's house? If you know the song, the king tells the page that the solution is simple. Follow in his own footsteps. Literally step in the print where the king has stepped. That's what he tells his page. And so the act of wonder in the story is that when the page follows Wenceslas and walks in Wenceslas' footsteps, the cold and the journey and the mission to help this man become actually bearable, become possible. He's able to do it, and they're able to do it together. And so the story and the song end with a simple conclusion and a challenge. Therefore, Christian folk, be sure, while God's gifts possessing, you who now shall bless the poor shall yourselves find blessing. Now, Wenceslas is a real historical figure, as we said. Great. But he was not a king, per se. So, sorry to let you down. He was just the Duke of Bohemia. So the song makes him a king. But he was the son of a ruler, a prince, and he controlled a duchy in a part of Bohemia where Christianity was actually being adopted at the time. And in that transition and the political instability of that, Wenceslas was caught between older pagan customs and traditions. I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that was the tradition in the area, and this growing influence of Christianity. So there was a clash. Now, I'm not by any means an apologist or a fan of state Christendom here, but history has it that Wenceslas was raised and educated by his grandmother, Ludmilla, and she had recently converted to Christianity, and she found the words of Jesus, and she played a major role in raising Wenceslas' faith and shaping his values. And so when he comes of age after being raised by her, he becomes the duke of his region, and he becomes known for governing in a way that emphasizes real care and because I've done the door thing and my pages are messed up. He becomes known for governing in a way that emphasizes care for the poor, generosity to the vulnerable, and personal involvement in charity. And so he was interested in a kind of poverty reform so that people were cared for. And as you can imagine, that made him popular with some, quite an outlier when it came to being a ruler. And it was so unusual that in fact, even after his death, a few biographies got written about him in the first couple of centuries, which is extremely rare in the 11th and 12th centuries for people to be writing books. And from those came the poems, the songs, the stories, and all of that is how we get the song that you all knew to sing the first two lines of today, which was written in 1853. This is actually a statue of Wenceslas. If you want to go see him in the Czech Republic in Prague, he's there. Have any of you seen this statue? Yes. Amazing. Yeah. That's really great. Okay, we're back. Stephen or Saint Stephen?
Stephen.
We got some Bible people. Thank goodness. Okay, good. Let us back up. Oh. This is not okay.
So you had all this planned already?
I had it all planned, and I was hoping I could choose the slides, but then I got here and found out I couldn't. So there's the plan in your head, and then there's the execution. In Acts 6, the story of the earliest communities following Jesus, what's one of the first activities they do? If you know your book of Acts, and I sure do, I was raised Pentecostal, the Holy Ghost falls, and then we never talked about the next part, which is ironic. So what are the first, what's the first thing that the early church organized themselves around doing? Making sure no one was hungry.
Yeah,
it was like so practical. Like they were just like, okay, we got to organize and make sure no one goes without it. It's like the first thing they organize. But by Acts chapter 6, the challenge has become apparent. It is not easy. The Greek-speaking widows in this very Jewish community in Jerusalem, it becomes apparent that they are getting overlooked. And so the apostles, Jesus' OG 11 disciples that are left, they respond by appointing a group of 7 people to oversee the work, and so that the most vulnerable people are cared for in the community. And that's where we come to a man named Stephen. Thank you for choosing Stephen. His role is direct care for widows in need, serving tables. That's literally where the word deacon comes from. It meant waiter, essentially. Not that restaurants were big back then, but you know, serving tables. So why widows? Widows were particularly at risk because when their husbands died, and if there were no savings or inheritance, and they had no male relatives, with economic means, they could become destitute. No land meant no means, and no means meant having no money, and no money meant having to sell yourself into slavery or indentured servitude or that kind of thing. But it begs the question, why would the earliest churches in the Jesus movement that they were calling the Way, why would they trouble themselves with that? Like, didn't they have sexier things to do? You read the book of Acts, and like the shadow falling on somebody heals them. Like, you think they'd be like, let's try to do that. And instead, they organize themselves around, you know, not so much soul saving, but bringing things to people who have need. They recognized that taking care of the most vulnerable was a responsibility that was rooted in Israel's legal and ethical tradition, going all the way back to Deuteronomistic law. Now, what the prophets always rail about in the Hebrew scriptures, do you know? Is it not enough altar calls, not enough praying, not enough Bible reading? What are the prophets always railing about?
Injustice,
people not having enough, the ivory beds, right? People laying in their wealth while so many went without. They're always emphasizing social justice, protecting anyone without social or economic power. And the law and the prophets consistently name 3 classes of people, in particular, who are most at risk in that society. The widows, the orphans, and
women.
And foreigners.
Yeah.
Widows, orphans, and foreigners. Here are just a few examples. God executes justice for the orphan and the widow. This is Deuteronomy 10. Loves the foreigner, giving them food and clothing. You shall also love the foreigner, for you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. Did you catch the why here? Why we care for those who are less off, less well off. The character of Israel's God, Yahweh, the actual character of Yahweh, is the basis for how the people following that faith were to treat the poor. Care for the widows and the vulnerable wasn't just a policy. It directly flowed from the character of God, Yahweh. Israel is told to mirror those acts. Justice first, you can see here, then provision, and then memory of how vulnerable we are always. So this is the foundation, and everything flows from this. Next is a policy. At the end of every 3 years, you'll bring out the full tithe, that's 10% of all the income that anyone made. The Levite, the foreigner, the fatherless, the widow, they'll come and eat and be filled. So here we have this 3-year practice that was baked into social policy, the government, you could say. To put that into perspective, that's 10% of everyone's wealth straight to the poor. So if we did that, just for example, in Canada, in 2023, the aggregate income earned in Canada was $1.9 trillion. So that, if we were doing this, if this was Canadian policy, it means every 3 years, $190 billion would go straight into alleviating poverty every 3 years, in addition to, like Israel had, all the other things that were built into the system to make sure no one was poor. Care is built right into the economy. This isn't just being generous when moved or when you have extra. It's a scheduled communal redistribution of resources. If the most vulnerable were not eating in this society, it wasn't on them. It was the system failed. Something was wrong with how we were conducting ourselves. The community has failed, not the widow. And that's why every third year there's this pooling of wealth and resources. And the widow and the orphan, the foreigner are prioritized. Imagine every 3 years if we had a theme in community. Widow, orphan, foreigner. Everybody has enough. Over and over and over, every 3 years. Simply to make sure no one falls between the cracks. Persistent attention that help is on the way. And then the next one. You will not deprive the foreigner or the fatherless of justice. When you reap your harvest and sheaves fall along the way, you won't go back to get it. It'll be for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Now, this is interesting. This is clearly a farming thing. When farmers went out to gather the harvest, a portion of that would always fall along the way. And in fact, there were separate laws about cutting the corners of your field. So they weren't allowed to go back and clean up. They were to leave anything that fell out there so that anyone who was poor and hungry could come and collect some. And in a lot of cases, it was right after the workers, right? If you're familiar with the story of Ruth, that's what she's doing. This is not, farming is not like a tertiary industry here. This was an agrarian society. This was like their primary industry. And so here we have like the economic engine of ancient Israel provide and saying literally, this is your primary source of revenue and subsistence and sustenance. And the law spells out, the law forbids efficiency when efficiency harms the vulnerable. How would we write something like this for AI right now? Just kidding, AI is not actually making any money. All right, you're commanded here to leave food behind, to accept loss as a producer, as a business person, so others can have, right at the source. And then there comes the reason, right? Remember, you were slaves in the land of Egypt. Memory here, memory is the moral engine. Have you been hungry? Have you ever gone without? Remember, even if you never did, your community once did, your neighbor once did, people who lived on this land once did, and that becomes the basis for remembering how we act. And lastly, there shall be no poor among you. If there is among you anyone in need, don't be hard-hearted or tight-fisted. That's Deuteronomy 50. The ancient law of Israel assumes poverty might exist, but refuses to accept indifference in the members of the community, in the citizens, because together they had to overcome it, and they could overcome it with active measures and with policies and remembering. So, back to the early churches. When Acts 6 says widows are being overlooked, it's triggering all the stuff we just read. Because Deuteronomy and Jewish culture repeated these mandates so often that Jewish society and the followers of Jesus would have had it baked into their moral consciousness. And so, in following Jesus, the apostles don't say, oh, well, that's unfortunate when they see poverty. Or they don't say, well, this is the Jesus way, not the Old Testament way. They don't say that's someone else's problem. They don't say it was the widow's fault or, you know, the man who died should have saved better or something like that. Yeah, they say stop everything. Fix this. This is the priority. This is the way. They appoint 7 people to oversee it. This is pure religion, as James says, right near the end of the Bible, if you think it ever phases out. Taking care of widows and orphans, this is the way of God with us, the Christmas story. It was the way of the earliest church, and it was the way of a man called Stephen. Which I guess leaves us just one more door. So we can all agree. St. Stephen, New Brunswick time. The late 1700s, this part of the world is being very intentionally organized by the British Crown. So after the American Revolution, thousands of loyalists, people who remained loyal to Britain in the United States fighting for their independence, they moved north into what was called the colony of New Brunswick. Yeah. The Crown responded by creating new counties and parishes. Charlotte County was created in... No, earlier than that. 1785. after Queen Charlotte, the wife of King George. I'm glad I didn't know this 2 weeks ago, so that's okay. Thank goodness for the work of Mr. William F. Ganong here. I got deep into the weeds of his 1896 monograph called A Monograph of the Place Nomenclature of the Province of New Brunswick. I recommend it.
Page Turner.
But honestly, there's not much out there about this area except what he wrote. We owe so much to him, so it's amazing that there's a statue there. The following year after Charlotte County was established, 1786, the colony was divided into six civil parishes. These parishes were not treated like the way that we use them in the modern sense. That was the word for kind of a administrative unit for courts and taxation, legal rights, etc. But the names that were chosen for these parishes are interesting. Anybody want to shout? Anybody want to take some guesses? St. George. So these were all the five original parishes were named after saints that were recognized by the Church of England. Okay, so here's like an old map. This is from like the early 1800s. So we got St. Andrew, which was one of the first disciples of Jesus, brother of Simon Peter, remembered as an early missionary. According to tradition, he was crucified in the shape of an X, which is why Scotland has the blue cross. St. David. David was a 6th century monk and bishop in Wales. He founded the monastic movement. He died after years of leading and teaching. St. George, a Roman soldier who became a Christian martyr, a symbol of resistance to the oppressed. Tradition holds he was executed for refusing to renounce his faith. St. Patrick played a central role in spreading Christianity in Ireland and after being enslaved there, and he died after a long life of pastoral work. A lot of people are familiar with his work. And then there is St. Stephen. He appeared, of course, as we just said, in the book of Acts, overseeing the care of widows. That's where we live, St. Stephen, our namesake. He is our namesake for where we work and play and live together, somebody who took care of the most vulnerable in societies. And then the first mainland parish after that, I heard somebody say, was St. James, brother of Jesus. So here we are on Pasquotamacati land, foreigners ourselves, in a place named after followers of Jesus. Does any of that determine how we approach our neighbor? And how we ourselves hope to be approached by our neighbor. I have got to now tell you one more thing about this thing on the side says full battery. Look at that green bar, just full, apparently. I have to tell you one more thing about Stephen, our municipality's namesake. As he served the widows, he also spoke about justice. He told Israel's story just like the prophets did. And so as he was working and helping the poor, he wouldn't keep his mouth shut. Yeah. And so he was spreading this message to people with power. You keep resisting the very justice you claim to believe in. We're intended to be a system of compassion and love. The kingdom of God. Hello, this is what Jesus was talking about. The prophets talked about. Are we doing that? He talked about what was being called the way, the belief that Jesus of Nazareth was the fulfillment of Israel's story of radical love. And the disputes with Stephen and between Stephen and the powers that be escalate. So Stephen is brought before the magistrate, the Sanhedrin, the court, and he delivers a long speech. It's like one of the longest sermons in the whole Bible. You can read Acts 9, Acts 7 and 8. And he recounts Israel's history and critiques the resistance to prophetic voices in the tradition. And his speech is so powerful that it provokes so much rage that he is hauled outside the city and executed by stoning. And this, of course, was the lovely style of execution that was reserved just for heretics who, you know, weren't thinking right. So here's the last thing he said to the powerful and the comfortable just before he died. You stiff-necked people, your heart and ears still do not show the sign of God's covenant. You're just like your ancestors who always resist the Holy Spirit. Was there ever a prophet your ancestors didn't persecute? They even killed those who predicted the coming of the righteous one, and now you've betrayed and murdered him, you who have received the law that was given through messengers but haven't obeyed it. So yeah, that got him killed. He is the first recorded martyr in the Jesus movement. That's the arc of Stephen in Acts. The guy tasked with overseeing care for the poor primarily, and then sharing the way of justice and talking about it every chance he could, and then getting killed by it for following the deepest, oldest demand of the ancient faith. And now, if I might have to go over there myself. Yay. I'll tell you one more thing about Wenceslas. I don't know if you can see where this is going now. The hymn we know and love connects Stephen to Wenceslas. How and why? Well, there's two ways. Here's the part very few people know. It's not in the song. Wenceslas was known far and wide for the poor thing, like I told you. That made certain people around him very nervous. That put him at odds with members of the nobility in Bohemia, and even his own family, especially his mother, Dragomira, who became queen when his father died. And Wenceslas had a brother named Boleslas. There is a test after. He is another duke. And one night, his brother conspired with his mother and invited him to a feast and then ambushed him on his way to church and had him murdered. So, after his death, Wenceslas was quickly remembered not just as a fallen leader and someone who was very generous to the poor and very benevolent, but a martyr, like St. Stephen. Someone whose commitment to service cost him his life. And I'm sure there was other royal intrigue going on. So, when we sing Good King Wenceslas, we're not just celebrating some fairy tale king in the snow who did a nice thing. We're remembering someone whose commitment to service didn't just cost him comfort and wealth. They cost him his life. It made people very nervous. And there's a second way they're connected in the song. And of course, that is the Feast of St. Stephen. Any guesses what the Feast of Stephen was? Anybody know?
It's the day after Christmas.
Good. Day after Christmas? At least now we know when it was. Awesome. Yeah.
Is it the January 6th?
So depending on the calendar, sorry, I don't want to get into that, but yes, depending on the church calendar, the Gregorian calendar, the ancient calendar, this calendar, but it was always like right after Christmas. So we would say it's December 26th. We would say it's Boxing Day, which of course, in our culture, is just a day to throw out all the boxes, right? Get the recycling out of the house. What it meant back then, of course, was boxing up care for the poor, boxing up food, boxing up clothing, bringing it to people who had a need. And I just love that it's the day after Christmas. Think about that. Peace, love, joy. God has come, and the first day, you're hearing this theme. You're hearing this theme in the early churches and in Deuteronomy. The priority, the number one thing, the first thing we do after proclaiming God with us, God has come, peace on earth, goodwill to all people, is to serve the poor. It will be the rhythm of what we do, said the early churches. And said the church calendar. One of Jesus' most quoted sayings is, the poor will always be among you. I don't know if you've heard, the poor will always be with you. Jesus said it, and we say it like, there you go, the poor are always going to be there, so... And it's kind of like, so, like, dot, dot, dot. So what? What do we say? Are we saying Jesus just thought, yeah, well, all this social justice stuff, it'll never come to fruition. It's all futile. I don't think that's that what we're insinuating? There's something more going on when Jesus says the poor will always be with you. And I've showed it here many times. Just about everything Jesus said was an echo or a refutation or a clever spin on something in the Hebrew Bible, in the Torah. Jesus did this all the time. The better you know your Torah, the more interesting Jesus is when you read him and when you hear his words. So the place where he said, for example, you will be compassionate as your Father in heaven is compassionate. You read that and you're like, that's very nice. But the reason why it enraged people is because the scripture, the verse that he's quoting actually says, you will be holy as your Father is holy. So Jesus actually twisted scripture, which of course should get you stoned or something, and got Jesus in big trouble. But that's an example of the kind of stuff he did. So do you recall anything I mentioned this morning that bears a resemblance to the poor will always be with you? Anybody?
There will be no poor.
There will be no poor among you. Right? Right? And here's something I love about the way commands are structured grammatically in the Hebrew language, and you get this sense in English too. But it's more than just a little quirky novelty in the Hebrew. The way these commands are structured is a command and a hope and a promise. When you say shall, it's a command, but it's also a future state, right? For example, I shall return. That's not a command. It shall rain tomorrow. But also, when you say you shall not covet, that's a command, but it's also a vision, a hope, a promise of a future state. And that's the sense that it has in Hebrew, that these, the Ten Commandments, sometimes they're actually called the Ten Visions, the Ten Promises as well. So taken this way, when you say these things are a promise and a future state, you're saying you must not, and also you will not, because it's just not what you do. So this is not just, like I say, a phenomenon. It's baked into how they spoke and worked and were expected to live and love in the ancient Hebrew. The command and the promise, there shall be no poor among you. Jesus says to people who know the Torah, the poor will always be with you. The poor shall always be among you. When you cross it with that, to people who know the law, do you think Jesus is just saying, oh well? Jesus is looking at people and saying, remember, there shall be no poor among you, but the poor will always be with you. Something is wrong. Jesus is actually calling them out and reminding them of a command and a future state and a vision and a hope and a promise that hinges on how we will conduct and organize our lives. So now it's 2,000 years later, and we do have people among us with no food, no shelter, not enough clothing, not enough to get by, but it shall not be so. We're given a command and a hope and a promise. There shall be no poor among you. So how do we do that? Charity and giving, what each of us has, is an essential part of it, absolutely. The ancient prophets and Stephen and Wenceslas and Jesus all spoke of it, and they performed charity. But it also demands systemic change. Charity upsets no one, but systemic change, justice for the benefit of people in poverty, that upsets a lot of people. It didn't end well for the prophets, did it? It didn't end well for Jesus. It didn't end well for Stephen, for Wenceslas. I could go on. There are too many examples. Their style of love went too far. It challenged the comfortable. It attacked sound economic policy, like the law in Deuteronomy. And yet, even though men and women have been executed or assassinated over the centuries speaking out for justice, we know their names because of what they inspired, because of how their work of caring carries on to now, to us, because we know it's right. Christmas is here to remind us of many things, and especially that. The Feast of Stephen is here to remind us of many things and of that. St. Stephen, our namesake on our town, is here to remind us of that, to remind us to love systemically in a way that fixes systems of unfairness, to remind us to love upsettingly in a way that commands and promises change for the poor among us. So I'm closing with this. Earlier this year in a town council meeting, yes, I attend them all. It's a lot of fun. A fellow resident of St. Stephen took to the microphone at council and complained and worried for us that St. Stephen, New Brunswick, is, quote, turning into a therapeutic town. St. Stephen, a place, the place where residents, where we offer and provide healing for the poor and the addicted and the affliction, for those living beneath the mountain. To which I say, may we be so fortunate. Therefore, Christian folk, be sure, while God's gifts possess them, you who now will bless the poor shall yourselves find blessing. So back to our original question. How do I possibly peace, joy, hope, and love in the middle of all this after how many years you've been doing it? With charity, yes, with systemic change, yes, but most crucially, together, in the footprints of the ancients, in the footprints of the ancestors, and our very neighbors who are doing what the whole world needs in this place, right here, that we call St. Stephen. May this be so in 2026 and beyond. And may we be a place of peace, hope, joy, and love.